This is Focus 580, hour number two of our show, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. More than 22,000 people have been honored for saving Jews during World War II, but not a single Arab is among them. Our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Robert Satloff, believed that this was not the full story, and he set out to see if he could find at least one, an Arab hero who would change the way that Arabs view Jews and also themselves. And the result is a book that he has authored, a book that was published this past fall in November. The title of his book is Among the Righteous, Lost Stories from the Holocaust's Long Reach into Arab Lands. Public Affairs is the publisher. It's a book that's gotten a lot of attention, and we're pleased that he could spend some time with us talking about it here this morning. Let me tell you a little bit more about him. He is an expert on Arab and Islamic politics. He is executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Soon after the attacks of 9/11, he and his family moved to Morocco, where he began this search for Arab heroes of the Holocaust, and he's now back living in the United States, and we're pleased to have him with us. As we talk, questions and comments from listeners are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that they are brief as they possibly can be. We ask that so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many different callers as possible. Callers certainly are welcome. 333-9455 is the number if you are here in Champaign-Urbana where we are. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you have questions, you are welcome to call. Dr. Satloff, hello.
Yes, hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
We appreciate it. To begin, I'd like to have you tell the story of how it is you started thinking about this in the first place. And indeed, it does go back to the attacks there in New York on September 11th.
Well, my own personal story with the history of the Holocaust in Arab lands does go back to 9/11. When I was in Manhattan and had my own Manhattan experience, it was certainly no worse than many and a lot better than most. Mine was merely to see what happened and to have the image in my mind of the planes hitting the towers morph into the image of the chimneys of Auschwitz with the smoke billowing out the top. And I got to think that afternoon and over the next few days about the relationship between the Holocaust and what happened on 9/11. 9/11, of course, only for a couple of hours, but the formula was the same, which was to kill as many people as swiftly and efficiently as possible using the greatest technology of the day. And I began to think about the culture in which the perpetrators came from, and I began to think about Holocaust denial in Arab societies. Not so much the idea that if Mohammed Atta knew more about the Holocaust, he'd have thought differently about 9/11, but rather the culture from which these people came. And I started I made a decision that my modest contribution to fighting the hatred that was manifested that day would be to try to combat denial and ignorance, really, of the Holocaust. And I began to think about new and different ways of talking to Arabs about the Holocaust, because whatever we've been talking about so far, while it's important and essential, it hasn't been effective. And so I came up with the idea one day of asking the question, did any Arabs save any Jews, rescue any Jews during the Holocaust? And if any did, isn't that the most positive response to denial of the Holocaust? Because if you accept these stories and there's something to be proud of, then you have to accept the context that there was a reason to save the Jews. And so that launched me on this research project looking for Arabs who saved Jews during World War II.
Recently, it seems there have been a number of examples of prominent leaders in the Arab world who have dismissed the Holocaust, either tried to minimize it or perhaps deny that it happened altogether. And certainly, perhaps one of the most prominent would be the president of Iran. Is it the case that Holocaust denial in the Middle East, particularly among political leadership, in recent years, has that somehow, is it more intense? Is it simply that people are talking about it more publicly, or is that something that has always been there and that perhaps we just haven't really been aware of it?
Well, there is this intense fascination in many parts of Arab and Muslim societies with Jews, with the Holocaust, with conspiracy theories about Jews. It's been there for a long time. The president of Iran, who you referred to, of course, is Persian, not Arab. But the antecedents of this are deep in Arab societies. It was 40 years ago that the president of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser, told a German newspaper, of all places, that you'd have to be a fool to think that 6 million people were killed during the Holocaust. And we see this today. The president of Syria has uttered similar concepts. We see it all over. My own view is that ignorance is even a greater problem. I mean, people who deny the Holocaust make a political choice to do it. People who are ignorant do it because they know nothing about this part of history except what they read in popular culture, in Al Jazeera they see, or in mass media, which is completely filled with distortions and misrepresentations. And so I'm especially focused on ignorance of the Holocaust and to try to find new ways to offer Arabs a way to access and understand this this important moment for all humanity. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Holocaust gave us the word genocide. Genocide didn't exist as a term before the Holocaust. It's really important for everyone to understand where this came from and why.
I think that one of the things that about the book that is important is that there were a lot of people who would be surprised that the Holocaust, in fact, did reach into North Africa. As you point out in the book, that the perpetrators and the victims were overwhelmingly European, but the Nazis and their allies did take it into North Africa, even though the period we're talking about is relatively short, I think that the point you make in the book is if the Nazis had managed to consolidate their control in North Africa and had managed to hold it, that it would only have been a matter of time before they would have put the same kind of program in place.
Yes, actually, when I first started this, I didn't really have an idea of the scope of the persecution in Arab lands, and I spend some considerable time in my book just explaining the context, what happened to Jews in Arab lands, especially in the Arab lands of North Africa, where for 3 years the Germans and their allies in Vichy France and fascist Italy applied many of the same elements of Holocaust-era persecution in these countries as they did in Europe. Wearing the Yellow Star, more than 100 labor camps for Jews, laws governing where Jews could live, what they could do for a living, whether they could go to school, racial laws, everything that occurred in Europe except extermination camps was applied in various degrees in these countries. And yes, I'm quite convinced that if the war had taken a different course in spring of 43, when the Germans were finally evicted from Africa, but if the war had taken a different course, then the 500,000 Jews of these Arab countries would have met the same fate as the Jews of Europe.
Some people actually were transported to Europe, to concentration camps?
Yeah, there were some numbers of Jews who were deported from Arab countries to Europe. And then there were a couple of thousand more who were stranded in Europe when war broke out. These were Jews from Algeria, Libya, Tunisia, etc., who ended up in Auschwitz. So the war did definitely touch these countries.
Hmm. Well, let me again just very quickly introduce the guest for this hour of Focus 580, Robert Satloff. He is an expert on Arab and Islamic politics. He's executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and is the author of a book that has now been out for a couple of months. I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore or the library. His book is Among the Righteous, Lost Stories from the Holocaust's Long Reach into Arab Lands. That's the subtitle. Public Affairs is the publisher. And it does indeed tell the story of the fact that the Holocaust did reach into Arab lands, and that not only were there Arabs who collaborated apparently quite willingly with the Nazis and their persecution of Jews, there were also Arabs who put their lives at risk to save Jews. And this was really one of his interests when this project began, was to see if he could possibly find some of those kind of stories. And indeed, he did. And they're in the book. Now, questions, again, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Right here at this point, because I mentioned the fact that, and you have mentioned that you went looking for these stories and that you did indeed find some. Tell one. Talk about one individual that you discovered and what you found out.
Thank you. Sure. Let me tell briefly the story of a remarkable man named Khalid Abdul Wahab. Khalid is the first candidate that Yad Vashem is considering to be formally named as a righteous. So let me tell his story. In the small Tunisian coastal town of Mahdia, Khalid was a very prominent local leader, the son of a former minister at the royal court. And one evening, Khalid learned from speaking with German officers during the occupation that a German was out to rape a blonde, beautiful Jewish woman. Khalid knew the family of the woman. He knew that they had already been evicted from their home, which the Germans had taken for barracks, and had sought refuge in an olive press factory. Well, that evening, Khalid got to that olive press factory first, banged on the door, and told that woman and her family and several other families that had also sought refuge there that they should come with him. And that evening, he ferried them all back and forth in his car to a farm that his family owned outside town. And he provided them with protection and refuge for the balance of the German occupation. It was really a wonderful act of selflessness and rescue. And it was told to me by the then 11-year-old daughter of that woman in question, who grew up and 60 years later tracked me down to tell me the story. She had been eager to tell someone all her life, and I had postings on internet sites all over the world, and she found me and she told me her story, and I was able to go back to her little hometown and confirm it by meeting some of her childhood playmates from 60 years ago who told me yes, that family was taken one night and protected on the farm of Khalid Abdul Wahab. And I was very proud to be able to confirm that story.
One of the big questions that comes up in connection with this work is that why is it that these kinds of stories are not better known? And there seem to be two ways of answering a question like that. In part, it might be because there hasn't been someone like you who actually went looking for them. But the other has to do perhaps with people's unwillingness, not so much those who were saved and connected to people who were saved, but people who were connected to the saviors who would rather not have it be known that some member of their family had done this.
Yes, you're absolutely right. There's really two reasons why, I mean, after 60 years, we're unable to tell these stories. You know, why has it taken so long? One, as you say, is that we, historians of the Holocaust in general, historians of the Middle East, Jews even, we haven't looked too hard. This hasn't been a feature of our inquiry. We've avoided this topic, and there's lots of reasons why that's the case. And then on the other hand, Arabs didn't want to be found. And I ran up against this, for me, a very strange phenomena of the families of some of these rescuers being quite reluctant, almost almost denying themselves that their father or grandfather might have saved Jews during the Holocaust. And this reflects, to a certain degree, the political overlay of the last 60 years, where at some point it became toxic in these societies to recall the heroic deeds of people who saved Jews. One of the objectives of my book, as I began to pursue it, is to detoxify this process and make it no longer objectionable, no longer a source of reluctance. And these are things that people should be quite proud of, whatever their connection to the later political disputes.
You mentioned the fact that Yad Vashem, the official memorial to the victims of the Holocaust in Israel, is looking at the case of the man that you talked about, considering adding his name to the list that they have of those who have saved Jews. And perhaps there might be others that, as a result of your work, or maybe now other people will carry this on, the names will come forward. I'm interested in what sort of reaction there has been to your project. And I have now some people said, yes, this is something that has been neglected, and we should do something about that. We should remedy the situation that there are on these official sorts of lists and official memorials. There definitely are other names that should be added, and we have been mistaken in neglecting them and not pursuing these kinds of stories?
Well, I've had a wonderfully receptive welcome to my book, both among Arabs and among Jews. I mean, I've had my share of critics, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. Some Arab critics accuse me of saying that Arabs are guilty of the Holocaust, which absolutely is not what I say. Europeans are guilty of the Holocaust. Arabs made choices, some to be perpetrators and some to be rescuers, but it's not a question of guilt. But generally, I've had a very positive reception. I'm very pleased that Yad Vashem has moved with remarkable swiftness to investigate the credentials of Khalid Abdul-Wahhab to be recognized as a righteous. Usually these things take a very long time, but I have, I believe, a very strong case, and so they're moving with great speed on this. I was just in Israel last week and was truly privileged to give a lecture at Yad Vashem on this issue. I mean, to be able to go to Yad Vashem and lecture on the Holocaust and try to impart new knowledge is a very daunting thing. This is the repository of knowledge and memory. But I was really quite moved that they would be so open to thinking about these issues in a way that they hadn't thought about them before. Mm-hmm. And I find that even in some Arab audiences, I spent several days in Egypt delivering virtually the same speech that I give in Israel. And again, not everyone was showering me with rose petals, but by and large, people were respectful and candid and open, talking about a topic that has never before been discussed in Arab societies, the Arab role in the Holocaust. And to me, you know, we should be modest about this, but to me, this is a great step forward.
You talked about the fact that that the Nazis and the French, the Vichy French, who worked with them, and their allies, the Italian fascists, were involved one way or another in Northern Africa for this period of time, roughly from the summer of 1940 to the spring of 1943, I guess, over their period of time, that they moved in to this territory. And I guess we have to be careful about generalizing, because there would have been a number of different governments, local governments, that they have dealt with. But generally speaking, how did local government officials in North Africa react to these occupiers, and particularly to this project of rounding up Jews and putting them into labor camps?
It's a very good question, and it's a difficult question to answer. Because these local governments were not themselves in control of their own fate. That was the Europeans, the Vichy French, the Italian fascists, and the Germans who were really in charge. First, in Morocco, Moroccan Jews themselves were not sent to labor camps. In Morocco, the French actually deported from Europe a couple of thousand Jews to slave labor camps in Morocco, so it wasn't Moroccan Jews. The Sultan of Morocco took an important moral position aligning himself with the Jewish community. He wasn't able to stop the imposition of Vichy laws, but he took a public position associating himself with the Jews of Morocco. Similarly, in Tunisia, in the Bey of Tunis, that's what the ruler was called, the prince, the Bey, he had the most difficult position of all, because he was the ruler of the only country to have a German occupation, complete with the SS and the full architecture of persecution. And he did what he could to help Jews in Tunisia, all the while trying to protect his country, which was caught in the front line of what was, for several months, the most important battle in the European theater of war. So generally, they tried to align themselves with their Jewish communities while recognizing that they didn't have the power to stand in the way of what the Germans and their allies were trying to do.
For those people, and here, obviously, we need to make the point that the experience in the Arab lands was not unlike the experience in Europe, that there were some people who quite willingly worked with the Nazis and the others in persecuting Jews. There were some people that we know actually worked to try to help and to save Jews. And then there were probably a lot of people who really didn't do either of those things. They didn't.
That's right.
They just went on with their lives and they said, well, this doesn't have anything to do with us. But if you take a look at those people who did oppose the Nazi project, there could be some, you know, a variety of reasons they could do it. Everything from just the resentment against an occupying power and just not wanting to cooperate with anything that they would want to do, to a feeling that somehow they and the Jewish victims really had something in common, and that an assault on a neighbor is like an assault on you. And then ultimately, perhaps there were people who would make this argument that in Islam there's as in other religions, there's a religious obligation here to try to protect others. If you take a look at the various complicated sets of reasons why people did what they did, is there any clear way of answering that question? What were the most important motivators?
It really is a difficult question to answer. Why people do what they do is one of the great questions. We don't really know. We're not even sure even if people say. Even if people give their own explanation, whether that's truly why they do what they do. What is clear is that some of the Arabs of North Africa recognize that the Nazis, who may have wanted to win them over to the Nazi and Vichy line, but many Arabs realize that they were only slightly above Jews on the racial hierarchy that the Nazis had, and that, you know, first the Nazis were coming for the Jews, and pretty soon they would come for the Arabs, too. This was the line that was taken by many of the leaders in Algeria, for example, who absolutely refused to accept the bribes offered by Vichy France. When Vichy wanted to bribe Arabs to support their political program, they said, no, we're not going to do it. And not one did. It's really quite remarkable. But then sometimes it's just for pure humanitarian reasons. Jews were on the lowest rung of the ration ladder, so they had less to eat than non-Jews or Europeans. And I read and received remarkable stories, really moving stories, of Arab wet nurses who took in Jewish babies, Arab bakers who would bake extra loaves of bread for Jewish families. There wasn't some great strategic foresight into these decisions. It was neighborliness, humanitarianism, kindness. These people will never be remembered as rescuers, but they should be remembered for their simple human kindness in a time of war, which is really something, when one thinks about it, is still a remarkable deed.
Yeah. And of course, one has to acknowledge the fact that there were also Arabs who turned on their neighbors.
Yes,
who went with soldiers and went door to door and said, absolutely. Here is a Jewish person, here is a Jewish person, here is a Jewish person.
Absolutely. There were collaborators, indeed. Much of the persecution could not have happened without the collaboration of local Arabs either. Arabs served as guards at almost all of the more than 100 labor camps throughout these countries. Arabs went door to door with the SS, pointing out where Jews lived. You're absolutely right. There were collaborators as well as the rescuers. The majority, as you said earlier, the majority of people were indifferent. Mm-hmm. They were trying to survive for themselves and their family in a time of when their lives were turned upside down by war.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, just let me introduce again very quickly, Robert Satloff. He is an expert on Arab and Islamic politics. He's executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and he's the author of a book. It's been out now for a couple of months. The title of his book is Among the Righteous, Lost Stories from the Holocaust Long Reach into Arab Lands. It's published by Public Affairs. It is out now, and as he explained, it was his effort to try to investigate the, as the title says, the Holocaust in Arab lands, in ways in which it looks at how people both collaborated with the Nazis and the Vichy French and the Italian fascists, but also how there were certainly cases where Arabs helped, rescued, saved their Jewish friends and neighbors. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. One of the stories that you tell, I think, is remarkable in the book, has to do with the man who was the head of the Grand Mosque in Paris, who actually participated in saving Jews by giving them official papers that said they were Muslims.
Yes, there's a wonderful story about the founder and builder and imam of the Grand Mosque of Paris, the most important Muslim religious institution in all of Europe. And the story is that he saved up to 100 Jews in a very clever fashion. He gave them certificates so they could pass as Muslims and thereby evade arrest and deportation. These were principally Jews from Arab countries, Jews who had names that were not too dissimilar from Arab names and who had a similar cult milieu as Arabs from North Africa. And one fantastic example of a very prominent Jewish singer named Simon Halali, this man, Sikador Ben Gabrit, the head of the mosque, went so far as to inscribe Halali's grandfather's name on a tombstone in the Muslim cemetery outside Paris, so that there was an extra layer of protection that Halali had when the Germans did come for him, and he could say, no, I'm Muslim, and just look at the cemetery, look at my grandfather's tombstone as proof. And Halali died just a couple of years ago, and almost every obituary mentions that Ben Gabrit saved his life in that very clever way.
Mm-hmm. What's, I think, kind of remarkable about that particular story is that the Nazis discovered what he was doing and apparently sent a letter saying, stop it. It seems to me surprising that they didn't arrest him after they found out what he was doing.
Well, there's compelling evidence that he was brought into German headquarters in autumn of 1940. It was very sternly warned to stop what he was doing on behalf of Jews. And you ask an interesting question, why wasn't he arrested and sent away? And that's because the Germans were playing a very delicate game with the Great Mosque of Paris, which they wanted to use as a way to win over the popular sympathies of Arabs and Muslims throughout Arab countries. So they didn't want to have a public fight with the head of the mosque, but they were very stern privately telling him to stop doing what he was doing.
We have a couple of callers here who want to join in the conversation. Certainly we welcome that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We will start with however someone in Urbana, and that's line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
It's certainly an important story you're telling, but to ask the question of why Arabs may not see this as too remarkable. After all, they've been giving sanctuary to Jews driven out of Europe for the past 500 or so years.
Well, it is absolutely true that at the time of the Spanish Inquisition, large numbers of Jews found refuge in Muslim lands, both of North Africa and in Turkey. And that was a very important moment.
And the Middle East.
Well, it's a very important moment in the relationship between Jews and Muslims. I think I always make the point that we should not over-mythologize the Jewish-Muslim relationship. It is absolutely true that there were these important moments of cooperation and friendship.
I shouldn't say it was an important moment. During the 700 or so years, during the entire period of Arab dominance in the very early period of Islam, There was quite cordial relations between Christians, Jews, and Arabs. You frequently found synagogues next to mosques.
Well, I think what you're saying is correct, but not complete.
Well, nothing is complete. The majority of instances would be on my side. In fact,
well, actually, no. I think it's much more important to recognize the following. First, it is absolutely true that you were better off being born Jewish over the last 1,500 years in a Muslim land than in a Christian land. That's absolutely true. You weren't going to be burnt at the stake, and your kids weren't going to be sent off into slavery. But it is not true to suggest that there's anything approaching equality between Jews and Muslims in Muslim lands over the last 1,500 years either. Jews lived as a tolerated minority, tolerated at best.
Well, they had legal guarantees, as did Christians.
Well, the legal guarantees...
And a commercial equality would have been there.
No, actually,
they would not have had the right, political rights.
It was much deeper than that. There were restrictions throughout these countries on where Jews could live, what they could do for livings, whether they could educate their children, what clothes they could wear. It was a very uneven existence over time and throughout different countries. Again, this is not to say that Jews approach the position that they had in Christendom, but it is also not to say that the Golden Age of Andalusia was the norm throughout the last 1,400 years, because it wasn't.
Death of Muhammad for about 400 years, when the Arabs actually were the dominant power and not Turkish or other groups. Because remember, after about the year 1000, the Islamic civilization was no longer ruled by Arabs. But during that earlier period, there was economic and cultural equality for all. The rulers were Arabs, yes. But that's more than certainly was true of Europe.
Well, I think it's a bit of a stretch to use the terms equality in any sense. Again, I try to be quite precise in all this, and it was better off to be Jewish in Muslim lands. That's true. Than in Christendom, but it was not a rose garden. It was a very difficult existence in many places and many times.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller for the comments. Let's go on to Champaign County for someone else here, line number two. Hello.
Hi. On that last interrogatory, whatever the, those were monarchies. Obviously, the idea of civil and human rights weren't even really formulated in the people who were serfs or in some ways subalterns, dominated by others in society, they also, there was no bed of roses for them either. So I'm not justifying any specific, but I actually wanted to call about, and I hope you don't find this too much of a digression, because I think it's an important point when one starts talking about what was going on during the war in the Maghreb and into the Middle East. It seems there's an untold story chronicled by, there's a book called The Transfer Agreement, which is a more, I guess, pro-Zionist record of it. But Lenny Brenner actually has three books out, called Zionism in the Age of the Dictators, where he chronicles offers of cooperation between the Stern Gang and the Nazis several times, that it was important enough for them to fight the British that they would actually, during the war, offer collusion with the Nazis. Now, I know you're going to say this is not what you're writing a book about, but there are some books out of this, but it very rarely gets treated here. I know there's more discussion of it in the Israeli press than there is in other places, and I expect you to, I don't know how you'll react, so I'll just ask you how you'll react to that.
Well, my first reaction is yes, this is not the subject that I'm focusing on. The, And my second reaction is generally I am quite dismissive of the arguments that try to suggest that Zionists and Nazis were in cahoots because they shared the same objectives. And
I said some. I said the Stern Gang.
Or the Stern. I reject the arguments of collusion. I think that at the very most, one can find evidence that various Zionist organizations worked to bring as many Jews as they could to Palestine and worked with whatever leaders that they could find to bring Jews to Palestine. But I reject the ideas of collusion, which really imparts all sorts of venal, malicious intent to all this.
We just have, moving into about our last 15 minutes here, and I want to get some, invite other people who are listening to join the conversation and get us back to the topic of the book as well. Questions are certainly welcome here. Questions, comments, always welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And again, our guest is Robert Satloff. He is the executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's an expert on Arab and Islamic politics, and his book is Among the Righteous, Lost Stories from the Holocaust, Long Reach into Arab Lands. It's published by Public Affairs. It's been out now for a couple of months. Altogether, how many Jews were living in North Africa at this time? Is that known?
Approximately a half a million. Approximately.
And is there a good number about how, as the result of deliberate persecution, as you have explained, or if people are listening, that there were no extermination camps in North Africa. There was no Auschwitz in North Africa, but what there were labor camps, and more than 100 of them apparently, and a lot of people died. Is there some good number about, in fact, how many North African Jews died?
Well, the best numbers I can come up with were approximately 1%, between 4,000 and 5,000 Jews from these countries died under Axis control as a result of the war, as a result of the persecution. Now, this 1% is not even comparable, not even approaching any comparable number to the more than half of all the Jews of Europe, of all the Jews on the Nazi Wannsee list that were to be targeted for execution. So I tend not to focus on the numbers so much because comparative persecution is a very difficult game to get into. How one's experience is one's experience, whether it was at a labor camp in Tunis or at a labor camp in Germany. But the numbers are about 1% in North Africa compared to more than half in Europe.
What were conditions in these labor camps like?
Well, in some of these camps, it was brutality and torture, approaching the worst that one would hear about and read about in Europe. Beatings, starvation, the circumstances of these camps themselves were horrible. There was one labor camp, and an internment camp in the Libyan desert, where more than 500 Jews died just from the terrible conditions. 500 out of about 2,500, so almost a quarter, died just of the terrible conditions, let alone, the brutality of the guards in some of these places. So these were, on the whole, pretty horrible camps to be in.
And these were local people who were involved in running, maintaining the camps. They worked as guards.
A typical camp would have one or two or three Europeans. Like the French camps would have foreign legionnaires, and then they would have local Arab troops acting as guards around the camp. And so that's why I point out that the participation of these guards was essential to the persecution of Jews in this part of the world.
Mm. You told a couple of stories. We talked about the man who was the head of the mosque in Paris. You talked about another man. There was just, because here we're talking about the fact that there were the existence of these camps, maybe you'll tell the story of a man who had a place where he lived nearby one of these camps, and at one point some of the people who were there held in the camp managed to escape, and he took care of them.
Yes, this is another fantastic story. This is about a man named C. Ali Sakat, a former mayor of Tunis who retired in the late 1920s to a farm that he owned in the Zaghouan Valley, about 35 kilometers west of Tunis, which happened to be right along the battle line for some of the most vicious fighting between the Allies and the Axis in Tunisia. And one day in the heat of battle, about 60 Jews who had been interned at an Axis labor camp made their way to his farm and banged on the door. Their camp was just on the next piece of property from what he owned. They made their way to his door and banged on the gate of the farm, and he had to decide whether to let them in. He didn't know whether the Germans or the Americans were going to win this particular battle, but he still made a decision. He let all of them in, and he provided them with protection and refuge until the Americans and the Brits had defeated the Germans, which is another example of a selfless rescue at a time when not enough people made that important choice.
You talked earlier about the fact that this whole project really began in part because of your personal experience, at least having been at in New York at the time of the 9/11 attacks and thinking about them, which then got you into thinking about the Holocaust, and then got you thinking about this idea of exploring the Holocaust in Arab lands, and then making this next sort of jump to this question: were there Arabs involved in saving Jews, as there were in some places in Europe? And you went off, and eventually, after traveling and talking with a lot of people, this is the result. And that your hope was, you said initially, that maybe your hope would be that somehow hearing these stories, knowing these stories, might have some kind of impact on the tension, the animosity between Arabs and Jews, and it might make some dent in that problem. I think that other people have said that while this project uncovering these stories and writing this book is a good thing, that somehow that's the other problem is so big that this just isn't going to do very much. isn't going to go very far. And that's not to, I don't mean to belittle
the effort. One of my critics actually accused me of being naive to think that that education about the Holocaust can have an impact in this part of the world. And I thought that was a bit of a cultural snobbery. After all, if you think about it, Holocaust educators have done amazing things in Europe these last two generations. Today, the perpetrators themselves are among the people with the greatest affinity for the history and the German people and their relationship to Israel, etc. And this was done through education, done through exploring what actually happened. My own view in Arab countries is ignorance, more than denial, is the most important obstacle to understanding about the Holocaust. And we have to find ways to access the Holocaust, to provide a way for Arabs to access the Holocaust. And it has to be different than the traditional ways, because the traditional way is a European story of European fascists killing European Jews. And in that context, Arabs say, why should I care? But if you tell stories in which Arabs themselves make choices to be perpetrators and choices to be heroes, then it's a very different prism to talk about the Holocaust. And my argument to Arabs is understanding the Holocaust and genocide more generally is essential. If Arabs knew more about genocide, then perhaps their reaction to the gassing of the Kurds at Halabja would have been different, and their reaction to Darfur would have been different and more effective. And we all pay a price for giving them an exemption from learning and understanding about genocide in general. And you can't learn about genocide unless you begin with the event that gave rise to the term genocide. The word didn't exist until it was defined in 1947 to describe the horrors of the Holocaust.
We have about 5-6 minutes left. We have two callers. I want to try to get them both.
Sure.
We'll go. They're both in Champaign. We'll go first to line one. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I know that I have a little bit of knowledge about some of the things that happened in the area of Palestine. Everyone knows about the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and his very closeness to Adolf Hitler and so on. Could you tell us some stories that you may have unearthed about positive events that took place either in Palestine or Syria or Lebanon or that general part of the world?
Well, I didn't focus... First of all, thank you for your question. I didn't focus on what happened inside Palestine because I tended to focus exclusively on countries that were under Axis control. And, of course, during the war, Palestine was completely under British mandatory control. Syria and Lebanon is a similar case in that although there was Vichy control in Syria and Lebanon, it was very brief, and it was over by 1941 when the Free French came into and took over in Syria and Lebanon. And the extent of time was not really enough to set up the architecture of persecution. Some early application of Vichy laws happened, but I don't really have the human sagas that I'm looking for to tell my story. That's why I end up focusing on North Africa, which is where the extent of Axis control was for up to 3 years.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, let's go to line two. This is also a Champagne listener. Hello.
Hello. You've been sort of making the point that there was a message here for the Arab world. Your book, is it published in Arabic in any way? How could you make any money if that's the only language it was published in?
I'll listen. Well, bye-bye. First of all, if I haven't given up my day job, thankfully, although this book is doing remarkably well here in the American market. I'm very pleased that the Holocaust Museum, the United States Holocaust Museum here in Washington, has found a lot of value in this book and is translating major portions of it into Arabic, into Urdu, and into Farsi to post on its website so that speakers of those languages can have complete and free access to it. I am also engaged in having a full Arabic translation and distribution, as I am a Hebrew translation and distribution, because I think it also has important messages for Israelis as well.
Has there been much reaction that you can talk about from people in the Arab world to the book and what you found?
Well, to my great delight, it's been front page news in countries from Morocco through Egypt and even to newspapers and media in the Gulf. They tend to focus on the two ends of the spectrum, either just the good news, Arabs who save Jews, or accusations that I somehow accuse Arabs of being like Nazis and therefore guilty of the Holocaust. Both ends of the spectrum sort of distort the whole story, but it's a beginning. And so I've been able to engage with journalists and media in all these countries, and, to my great delight, in many of these places, they're having the first ever serious discussion about the Holocaust that they've ever had. And, you know, again, as I say, we should be modest about this, but this is a great step forward.
Mm-hmm. Do you think so? I guess it's encouraging. It sounds like you're encouraged by the idea that in having done this project and published this book and getting people talking about this, you've actually started a movement that maybe will become something a little bit larger, or at least will go beyond this, and maybe some other people will come forward and will start telling some of these kinds of stories, and it will be something that will have a little bit of a momentum of its own.
Well, I'd be delighted. I mean, I think that there are more stories out there. I, at some point, just had to put a stop to my own research, but I'm quite sure that there are other stories to be done. I'm sure that there are hundreds of Holocaust-related sites in Arab countries which deserve to be memorialized, labor camps and other places. There are heroes that need to be recognized. There are perpetrators who need to be identified. And there is much research that should be done so that this important chapter of history, it's both Arab history and Jewish history and world history, can be fully brought to light.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that we talked a little bit earlier in the interview about the fact that at Yad Vashem they're looking at this one of these particular cases, and I think that it was the case of Khalid Abdul Wahab they're looking at this. Do you think that, in fact, if I'm remembering that's the right name, that he might be the first Arab to have his name officially added to the list there?
Well, I'm hopeful that that's the case, and this would be really big news. I mean, it would be a message for Israelis and Jews in general that about some Arabs who make different choices than, say, Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Mufti of Jerusalem, but Arabs who work to save Jews. And I think it would be a very important message to Arab societies that this institution in Israel, which is such a repository of memory, has reached out to recognize this very important deed that an Arab did to save Jews. And so I think it will have a lot of resonance among both societies.
Well, there we will leave it because we're here at the end of the time. If you would like to read the book that we've talked about, it has been out now for a couple of months. The title is Among the Righteous, Lost Stories from the Holocaust's Long Reach into Arab Land. It's published by Public Affairs by our guest Robert Satloff, who is Executive Director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And Dr. Satloff, thank you very much.
Thank you. This has been a real pleasure.